This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hello everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 364 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And today, we've got an incredible conversation with Sven Berg of the electronic music duo Royksopp. And this one is super fascinating because not only has Royksopp had several decades of producing some incredibly innovative electronic music, they've been nominated for Grammys, Brit Awards, and have built a tremendous fan base. But Royksopp have also attracted the support of other musicians and artists, one of which we discuss at length today, Banksy. Banksy himself hand-stenciled a limited release for Royksopp in 2001, and this record is now one of the most desirable records in the world. Only 100 exist, and each one made by Banksy himself. Now, Sven and I talk at length about that record today, as well as profound mysteries. Royksopp recently announced a hugely ambitious new album, Profound Mysteries. It's a three-part set, complete with a 6-LP box set, artwork, and video for each track. And you could dial up Profound Mysteries Volumes 1 and 2 right now on streaming services. And the third and final volume will be out November 18th, so set up your streaming services to get that on the day. You could also order vinyl copies, including the 6-LP box set, at profoundmysteries.royksopp.com. And hey, guess what? There's an extended version of this interview available only to our show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. I love giving a whole bunch of extras to the folks at patreon.com/vinylguide, including extended interviews, high-resolution audio files, and all episodes are commercial-free, only at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, $5 or $10 a month, or whatever you can afford is appreciated, and enjoy ad-free interviews, extended interviews just like today, another 10 or 15 minutes with Sven, I believe, as well as listen to it in high resolution. Your ears will love you for it, and so will I. Help support the show at patreon.com/vinylguide. Oh, and finally, if you're new to the Vinyl Guide podcast, please note there's over 350 other episodes and interviews available anytime you want, including the likes of Amon Tobin, episode 357 of The Vinyl Guide, Cut Chemist stopped by to talk about record collecting, episode 348, Ambrose Kenny Smith of King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, episode 325, Araldo Bernocchi, episode 315, Al Jorgensen of Ministry, episode 302, Andy Partridge of XTC, episode 255, Wolfgang Fleur of Kraftwerk, episode 140, and hundreds of other episodes. Subscribe to The Vinyl Guide with your podcast app. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. And with that, let's turn our ears toward Tromsø, Norway, and have a chat with Sven Berg on the profound mysteries of Royksopp.
I gotta say, I've been a long-term fan of Royksopp for many years, and I've got a lot of questions, and I was absolutely delighted when recently we learned that there were new albums in the works, Profound Mysteries. Now, the last album 8 years ago was titled The Inevitable End. Most people thought maybe this was the bookend of the career. Was that the original idea? Did you think it was the end too?
Well, The Inevitable End, to me, when we sort of set out to make that album, I did not intend that to be the last album, I must admit. To me, it was more the end of things, not meaning the end of times, but dealing with themes such as end of relationships and that kind of end. And things most definitely will, most things at least, will have an end, that kind of thing. Not necessarily pointing towards the album. But then someone close to me, not being me, but potentially my colleague, I do not know, managed to express that this might be our last traditional studio album, meaning that we, because we had some ideas to you know, as we have done in the past, to release music on different platforms, and not doing the traditional 10-track thing on a piece of vinyl. Mm-hmm. but we haven't really settled on it. But the cat had clumsily fallen out of the bag, so we just have to deal with that. But yeah, certainly it wasn't the end anyway. So either we were just clumsy, or we were lying, or we just, I don't know what we did, but certainly it wasn't the end.
Okay, but there was a long gap. I mean, 8 years, and now the new album, or albums, 6 records worth of material, booklets, arts, videos. How complete was this concept prior to starting it?
It was pretty complete. The idea of doing a double album is something that we have had, or something we were interested in doing for quite some time. And quite some time, I mean, possibly for the last 25 years or so. It's just one of those things we wanted to do. Having that, it's like a, what you call it, the bucket list.
No.
We had that on there. It needed to be done. But I guess it's partially because we hadn't done it earlier, because we felt we didn't have the gravitas, we didn't have the weight of doing that. I mean, if you're 19 and put out a double album, that's a bit too pretentious even for us. So we didn't dare to do so. And the two albums, Junior and Senior, were at one point meant to be like a double album. But as we started to work with them, we just realized it's we didn't feel that it would work. Mm-hmm. So we kind of split it. But the idea then to do a triple one, I'd say that started pretty soon after The Inevitable End. So it's been quite a few years in the making. It was just a matter of finding out how to do it the best way, because we had so many ideas we wanted to cram in.
Mm-hmm. So you set out to create perhaps a double album. You ended up with a triple album. And it went into, what is, 3 albums, 6 pieces of vinyl, certainly multiple media formats. How was it for you to be able to edit that? Because having those constraints of one album and a certain amount of music that could fit on a piece of media is a constraint which forces artists to edit. Now you have this blank canvas. How did you stop yourself from getting in trouble?
Well, with The Inevitable End, we said that it would obviously be going to be the last traditional studio album. So we felt we could exploit the fact with the new digital platforms that we could make or release longer tracks and so on, not be restricted by the physical restraints of let's say vinyl, which we have done, obviously. But then again, it's so hard to let go of the vinyl, and it was never really the idea. So with Profound Mysteries, we have a huge like cardboard thing that we have up in our studio, and we wrote down the ideas that we wanted to include in the project and assign sort of track ideas that we wanted to have on each of the 3 parts. So that was like the starting point. And one other sort of grand idea that we had was that we really didn't want tracks to sort of kill each other by like consecutive tracks to kill the previous or the following track, so that each of the tracks would have an equal worth. It sounds awful and pretentious when I say it like that, but it's, you know, we wanted to make it very evident and clear, and leave the listener with that sensation that, you know, they're all equal parts. So we had quite a lot of things that we wanted to take in consideration when sort of structuring the outline of the release. And then we tried to make tracks that would befit the ideas that we had. So it's actually a thing that was, the concept was made from scratch. So we sort of laid out the plans and then tried to, you know, follow that.
How are each of the 3 albums different? Or are they meant to be played consecutively? Are there different themes per album?
In my head, again, it's we don't want to, you know, force anything onto the listener. But in my vision, I would play them consecutively, The first part, and I think it's somewhat evident in the way that we've released them as well. But the first one was meant to be a re-entry of Røyksopp, like us re-emerging from wherever we have been hiding. And it's a slow build. It starts with a very sparse, with nothing, and it becomes something. Not only in sonically, but also in how the instrumentation is throughout the first, I'd say, three tracks. It's a slow build, and it's meant to be more of a... it's going to sound a bit pompous again, but it's meant to be more like a monologue. It's a bit more intro. It's like introverted, introspecting. It's more for the head, I guess. It's possibly something you would listen to with your headphones on. That's like an overarching thing. Well, yeah. In comparison to, let's say, the second, which is more present, has a bigger presence. It's more outspoken. It feels more like a dialogue. Possibly somewhat more accessible in terms of subject matter and so on. Again, eye of the beholder or ear of the listener would be, I guess, more apt.
Right.
And then the third one, we wanted to a certain degree mix those two thoughts, but I guess it's more leaning towards the second approach, which is more presence and more open. But whereas the second one is aimed a bit more at the hips, I'd say the third is aimed at the hips and the head to a greater extent than the second. These are just broad strokes and might not necessarily mean that much, but it's there are so many things that we wanted to cram in, as I said, in this concept. We wanted the first part to be a bit sort of retrospective, looking back. The second one is a bit more nowish, whereas the third is a bit more aimed towards the future. I think the biggest thing of note is that we, as stated before, we wanted to pay tribute to the different genres and styles and musical time periods that has helped forge Røyksopp and our sound. So that's also something that we wanted to cram in all of this. So it's quite a esoteric, I guess, would be the right word here, project with a lot of musical references to things of the past and different musical genres, without hopefully being too elitist in any way. But there's a lot of that in there for those who want to go looking for those.
Now, growing up, did you have access to a lot of records, a lot of music coming into the house?
Obviously, I grew up in Tromsø in northern Norway. Like, that's pretty remote. 69 degrees north, if you have a map of the world. So it's fairly remote, and obviously before the internet. But Torbjørn, myself, and two other guys had a sort of a, you know, we bought the vinyl that was available to us, and we would swap records. Like, I would borrow records from the three other guys, and, you know, we would circle it, because certainly records were expensive. And at least two of us, meaning myself and Torbjørn, had older siblings that would also, you know, contribute to the steady flow of music. But surely when we were kids, like from, I don't know, 6 till 14, you know, your income is pretty scarce and sparse. Yeah. And also the availability was pretty slim. So, you know, it's not as if we could get everything, but...
Yeah, all records were imports for you.
Exactly, exactly. That is true. And it's fair to say that we would not listen to anything domestic of Norway. That's for sure. It was all imports, yes.
When did you become aware that you had become a musician?
This is a strange one. for me, because I am by nature an introvert. So for me to recognize, I don't know if it has anything to do with introversion to recognize myself as a musician came really late. I even struggled to fill out like visa applications when traveling abroad.
What's your occupation?
Exactly. So I've been entertainer for quite some time. I sort of jokingly put down entertainer just to sort of escape the confrontation of putting down musician on it. But now it says musician. But on my earlier visas, it actually says entertainer and such, sort of jokingly. So I don't know when that happened, when I considered myself a musician.
So the very first single from Royksopp, So Easy, in 1999, was that your first time on record?
No, the first time was, I can't remember the year, but 1993, I think. Again, it was Torbjörn, myself, and our two other friends, sort of the four of us, ones that we, you know, the record bunch. We had our first sort of project together, and we put out a record in, I believe it was 1993, under the guise Adena Cycle, with a reference to the French artist Moebius, who made the comics and the illustrator,
right?
Possibly known for the Dune movies and so on. Yeah, a brilliant guy. Anyway, so that was the first thing we did on vinyl. Yeah,
was that Drum Island?
No, Drum Island came later. We did a lot of different projects at that time. Again, we started when I was 12 and the three other guys were 13. So that 1988. And then we have just done different little bits and bobs. But yeah, again, we just considered it a hobby and nothing big. So, you know, it was a really, we just made some music, released it and moved on kind of thing.
I guess, and I'm thinking through it now, correct me if I'm wrong, but in Northern Norway, I would imagine that the pool of musicians to play with and create with is rather small. And so, you know, it sounds like you were in orbit with Torbjörn and others for many, many years, which I guess would help really form a very tight bond, and you get to know each other very deep at a musical level, more so than maybe other locations where the field is so large and you could play with so many different people at any given time.
I think you're absolutely right. And well, the thing with Torbjörn and myself is that, you know, our friendship came first, and the friendship was sort of founded on a mutual common interest in specifically electronic music and certain movies, science fiction and comics and so on and so forth, but also very specific parts of music and comics. Like we would both be very attracted to Kraftwerk's Computer World, specifically that album. So there was so much common ground for the two of us. And as you say, there weren't that many other people at that time who felt the same. There was a lot of Metallica and Iron Maiden and so on around, which is fine, but certainly it wasn't what we were into. And then in addition, I think when you put two guys together with, again, quite a vast amount of curiosity and imagination, and who are starved for impressions, we just wanted to, you know, we wanted to know. But we are in isolation. You start to innovate, you start to create things, which is kind of what we did back then. But with no sort of plan other than this is something we do. Again, me referring to playing football in the, you know, out in front of the house, or just doodling on a piece of paper, like when you draw when you're sitting in class. We had the same approach to music. It was just something we we did without any
great plan. You explored together. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that first single, So Easy, in 1999, it's on the label Telly,
yeah,
which I believe was a record shop in Norway. Is that right?
That is correct. It was, it was a record shop initially, who obviously sold other artists' music. The guy who had the shop, Mr. Telly himself, wanted to start a label, but he had no artists. Torbjørn and I were quite, still are, quite lazy in terms of, those kind of things. So we said, well, we have some music that you can put out as long as we can have a few of the copies so that we can ship them out to different labels to trigger some interest for the forthcoming project that we have, an album. So that was kind of the deal. So that's the first single we ever did.
Do you know how many were made of that first single?
That couldn't have been many. Max 1,000, but I think it's got to be less, but I'm not sure. I think it's down to the hundreds, but I'm not sure.
Mm. It's very collectible. I'm sure you know that.
I think I actually have a few copies, and it's just, again, it's quite a nice embodiment of the community that were in Bergen at that time, because again, similar to the ones we had in Tromsø, which was like a community consisting of 10 people, all artists, i.e. the 10 people that were into electronic music at the time. The same thing happened in Bergen. There was electronic music was more established then, but certainly the community that sort of brought the attention to Norway at that time, that kind of consisted of eight people. So the guy who has drawn the comics that is found within the sleeve of the So Easy single is a famed Norwegian sort of pioneer, godfather of electronic music, whose name is Bjørn Torske. He's a legend and a pioneer within one of the sort of three godfathers of Norwegian electronic music.
Oh, and so he's just, the cartoonist.
Exactly. So it just goes to show how small the community used to be, at least, people helping each other and so on. Yeah.
So speaking of collectible records, the copy, the pressing of Melody AM with the Banksy cover.
Yes.
Is perhaps one of the most collectible records in the world. I'm sure you may know that those copies are tens of thousands of dollars. Constantly, that record is on the top of the Discogs most expensive records sold.
I didn't know. I think I have. I didn't know it was there on the top. I know I have number one and number seven or something like that. So they're in the shelf somewhere behind there.
Okay. Well, yeah, hang on to that. So tell me the story of that record and, of course, of the cover and working with Banksy.
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey, everyone. I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 used record into a $50 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
The pressing of Melody AM with the Banksy cover.
Tell me the story of that record and, of course, of the cover and working with Banksy.
Well, Melody AM obviously was the debut of Rakesop. That's the when Torbjörn and I, for the first time, had a clear and focused idea on what we wanted to do with a piece of music. We wanted to make something that was uniquely us, hence the name Rakesop, which is, you know, commercially a suicide, I think, because it's so tricky to pronounce and write and everything. So, but we were adamant that it had to be that, something that was a bit sort of exotic and strange and fun to us. And yeah, we just wanted to try to create music that felt that was lacking in the world. That's a tall order, but that's what we set out to do. Not trying to make it, you know, very narrow or inaccessible or you know, hard in any way. We wanted it to be easy, but still layered in such a way that it can be appreciated as a bit more than just easy listening, if that makes sense. So we wanted it to be pleasant, but layered and detailed at the same time. And we wanted it to be as much as we could. We wanted it to have longevity. So we tried to use sounds and production styles that wouldn't hopefully go out of fashion, you know, quick, which seems to be a trap that so many fall into. It becomes the flavor of the month and it just dies.
Right. Even like things like reverbs. Can data sound, yeah.
Exactly. So the idea was, and it's been kind of a Rakesop mantra ever since, is that we, by taking elements that are really retro, blended with really, you know, contemporary, and just try to mix this, you somehow lose track of what time period it belongs to. So, you know, you can use a snare from a drum machine anno 1985 that have a kick from 2022 and so on, and just mix it up so it doesn't become that one one color that is a palette that is very contemporary or of a certain time period. So that's kind of been the Rakesop way ever since. But returning, sorry for me digressing here, it's just,
oh, this is good. This is interesting because I like you have a philosophy when you go in that you want to create something that is timeless, that can be enjoyed in 10 years at the same way it can be enjoyed today.
Yeah. I mean, and again, it's, I don't know whether we succeed, but that's what we try to do. And certainly as a listener, you will very often tie music to a, you know, to the time period you listen to it regardless. So, you know, you can never escape that. But certainly if someone would listen now in 2022 to something that we did in 2010, they might not necessarily know that it was made in 2010. It's that kind of thing. But returning to Melody AM and the artwork, well, Banksy wanted, we were in London, obviously, dealing with Melody AM. And there's a link between someone we know there in London to Banksy, and Banksy wanted to basically just do a interpretation of the artwork, and you know, we had seen his work. Obviously, he wasn't as big of a thing as he is now. But we said, yeah, sure, nice. That would be excellent. You know, we loved what he did, you know, in his art. So sure, why not? Obviously, we didn't know. He might have known, but we didn't know that he would become the, you know.
Such a phenomenon.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And influential and all that stuff. But yeah, it's just one of those things. I it would be a lie if we were to say that we knew that this would be in a couple of years on the top of Discogs.
of course. Things. Was it like here are, because it's 100, it's an issue of 100 records. Each That's one true. Of them, if the listeners don't know what we're talking about here, it's a it's each one is hand spray painted with a stencil from Banksy himself or herself. Was it like giving over to Banksy 100 blank record sleeves and just saying, come back with something interesting?
Yes, that's kind of it. It's as simple as that. And we obviously had the artwork for Melody I Am. So he, from what I understand, drew on that, the existing artwork for Melody I Am. So yeah, it was as simple as that. We, you know, at carte blanche, the guy is an artist, and we appreciate that in you know, in any artist, that you know, you should have your vision, and you should do you kind of thing. And the funny thing is that you can see there's a different green color from the 100, like the initial whatever 50 or so has a slightly different color than the last batch in terms of the green. So it's just for those who are intrigued by those kind of things.
Okay.
We clearly had to swap can at some point.
And how were those 100 records distributed?
It was distributed to DJs and fans. It was so early, but to friends and so on. And I know some PR people had a few of them. Yeah, that's kind of how it was. And I know some of the people within the label in London had some of them. But you know, we didn't know what it was, other than a really nice piece of memorabilia of the time. And it just felt fresh, and you know, I hadn't seen that before myself, certainly. So they were just distributed by promoters and DJs and so on, as you would, like promoting a new album. Yeah.
Would people at that time, this is 2001, would they have recognized, oh, this is this Banksy I've started to hear about? Or everyone, it was way before people actually had him in their consciousness?
I think, I was about to throw the word hipster around, but certainly a certain segment of the scene in London at that time would definitely have known that. And in 2001, he had already made the you know, the little monkey and so on, that you could see some of his art at certain places in London. So he was certainly known, but not, I guess, taken in by the cultural elite of the world, right, and so on. Yeah, so it was, at least as far as I know, it was a smaller thing. And I believe after he had done this, he was asked by Blur to do design something for them, I believe. But that wasn't handmade. He designed the artwork, but right. he it's not. I think we are the only ones which are handmade or hand painted, from what I understand.
Yeah. All right. Well, make sure you get extra insurance.
Yeah. I'm going to dig them out now. They're literally standing. I could possibly show you. They're standing in one of my shelves over here.
Actually, go grab one. Go grab one. Can you grab number one? Let me see number one.
Yeah, yeah. Hang on for a sec. This is number one. It's actually in the sleeve. So
that's very green.
Yeah. Yes. And it says, it's possibly a bit faded, but it says number one there. I don't know if you can see them.
I can.
I also saw that I have a number 7 here as well.
Is that your lucky number? The
I possibly had an idea when I picked this out, but that's 7 of 100. So, but yeah, I don't know. It was so many years ago, and I was a different man.
Wow, that's fantastic. I love that story. And I figured that was, it probably happened similar to that. There was a mate of a mate exactly. made the connection, and he seems like a very, you know, very generous guy to the artistic community.
He certainly is. And this is a, you should, speaking of Banksy, he came to Norway around that same period. You know, this friend of ours tagging along with a friend that we know. And he did some of his art here in Bergen. And then he also did some pieces for a friend of ours who had a nightclub. And what happened then is that the town hall here in Bergen, they didn't like his art, so they painted over it. So, yay, very clever. They clearly didn't understand what they were dealing with. The guy who got the, I think he had 3 pieces that Banksy made, PC made for this guy here in Bergen. He saved those, and I believe he sold one of them. And for the money he got for that, he set up a shop here in Bergen that's doing like a clothing fashion shop. And then he sold a second one at some art gallery a couple of years ago in London, like Sotheby's or something like that, for like millions. So I think he bought himself a house and so on for that one. And he has the third one sort of still sitting in his living room.
Oh, wow.
And that was just a random, like a random thing. He literally just had a few canvases standing in his, you know, in his flat, and Banksy said, "Oh, I can paint something here as a thank you for, you know, buying me a beer, whatever, that kind of thing." And yeah, the guy literally got a life handed on a plate by Banksy. But it's a nice little fairy tale, and it's true.
That's like when Picasso used to pay for his dinner by writing a sketch on the napkin.
Exactly, similar kind of thing. You know, I love. Yeah, I like those.
Yeah. So with all the Royksopp music, do you guys have control of it all? Is it all something that's under, that could be released, for example, on Dog Triumph?
No, we do not. It's a bit of a tricky one, that. And because we were signed to a label that went bankrupt and was bought up by another label, and then it's that tricky thing, is that who's then owning it and rights and so on, and to be perfectly frank, we don't spend too much time on those things. We sort of say yeah, look into it. We just want to sit in the studio and mess around with the drum machine as opposed to spend hours fighting. But we do not.
Yeah, and I totally get that. And the reason I ask is because many of the Royksopp records are out of print.
Yes.
And many of them are very costly, you know, to be able to find. So the thought is at some point, would you foresee some of those records getting repressed? Or do you think people better not hold their breath?
No, we want to repress them. It's nice to be wanted, is what I'm saying. And I don't want people that appreciate our music to be fleeced in any way. So I would really like for it to be available for anyone who's interested. We are all about the fans, I guess. That's mm-hmm. Those are the ones other than ourselves, those are the ones we want to please. Mm-hmm. We want to be there for them as much as we can. So we did repress Melody AM a batch, and we intend to repress more as soon as we get a green for go. And it's been a couple of tricky years in terms of vinyl, as you possibly know, due to Well, they tend to say pandemic and the war. I hopefully it's true, but you know, and we're not first in line there. There's always the sharks of the record industry who are first in line. So and we're just a little, yeah. I don't know what we are. Plankton.
You're competing with Taylor Swift for the record pressing.
That's one of the names. No, disrespect to her, but it's true. But Adele and Taylor Swift were the ones that cropped up. Yeah.
From what I understand, the record pressing plants are starting to get back on a schedule, a little bit more of a feasible. It's under 6 months from what I understand now.
Yes.
They've all ramped up capacity. So, And speaking of which, with this, with the three double record sets for Profound Mysteries and the six disc box set. Those are available to order now. When do you envision those would be able to ship?
Well, I don't want to lie. That's very important to me. But I believe my management said that they were expecting it to be. What did he say now? What did he say? He said that he is receiving not a test pressing, but like a print of the actual physical product, the box set, as it were, with the sleeve and everything this week, so that, you know, for us to have a look at and whatnot. And I do not know the time, but I will check that with my management after I hang up, because I should have had that. But sure. I haven't heard anything other than it should be available upon, you know, close to the release of the album, part three, which is not too far away. It's like, I don't know, a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So fingers crossed. That was the idea at least. But again, pandemic and war and Taylor Swift.
Yes. Yeah, between those three things, the record will come out at some point. And it does look beautiful. And for folks who want to take a look at this, roiksopp.com, or specifically profoundmysteries.roiksopp.com, you could buy each of the installations, the three installations separately, or you could get a box set that comes with a booklet. It's got some amazing artwork. There's an Australian artist you've been working very closely with, Jonathan Zwanda. Now, when Jonathan was making this artwork, him being on the other side of the world, did he have access to the music? Was he able to listen to the music and kind of make designs based on that?
Yes, that is true. He was. He was with us from pretty early on, a couple of years ago, in that phase. So we would feed him the music and the ideas and like the concepts that we had even before the track was made. We would say, this track is going to be about, and then, you know, sentiment, BPM, key, and so on before it was made. So he would have those things to go by, you know, which can be demanding on his end. But the fun thing, there are so many reasons why we wanted to work with the wonderful Jonathan, other than his art, but it's his approach to what he does as well, because he has that artisan touch. He and just like us, he doesn't separate between his digital domain and his analog or hands-on, because his painting and, you know, the digital treatment and so on is intertwined. He considers it one thing, just as we do. You know, we don't say that we work in one or the other. We just, you know, we do certain things in the digital domain and certain things electroacoustically or outboard, and it's just one expression, and he has the same sort of take on his art.
That's interesting, because that goes back to what we were talking about, not dating the sound. His art is not necessarily one that you could look at and say that's from a particular period. It too seems to have a timeless element to it.
I agree. Obviously, you know, you wouldn't say, oh, that's made in 1972, but it could have been. It could have been by, you know, if you look at certain, again, returning progressive rock, that seems to be the theme of the day for me. But certain, you know, if you look at the wonderful artwork of certain...
like albums, Roger Dean?
For instance, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing. It could have been... you know, some sort of alien landscape or artifact of that era. So there is, I think there is a timeless quality in Jonathan's work as well. Mm-hmm. And we obviously wanted the so-called artifacts, as we call them, the little artworks that goes, there's one artifact or artwork per track. So there's 30 pieces he made, mm-hmm. Jonathan. We wanted them to have a quality of being timeless and hopefully raising a lot of questions and wondering, what am I looking at? Is it alive? Is it dead? Is it alien? Is it arcane?
Is it going to hurt me?
Is it friendly? Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we wanted it to be evocative in that sense.
And along with not only just one image per song, there's also a video for every song, which, yes. Again, I mean, could you get more ambitious with this? I mean, did each of the video directors have a similar brief, or you just let them go?
The brief, it was more dogmatic. The brief, it's highly influenced by the Danish dogma school of making, like Lars von Trier and so on. We gave them an allowance each, like this is the money you have, and it was a small budget. It's got to be more than 20 seconds, I believe, was the second thing. And you can do whatever you want, but you need to include some element of the music that you have been designated, the track you've been designated. But if you want to just, you know, take a little and reverberate it as your soundbed, or just have a little, you know, microsecond of it in there, that's fine. But we just need it to be, you know, a grain of the music in there. Other than that, you know, go crazy and please do not make it offensive. Which nobody did, you know. And you can be provocative, but not offensive, I think was the mm-hmm. was the final thing.
So yeah. You and Torbjörn would send out these missions, mm-hmm. and then get the video back and be surprised, hopefully, and delighted, I guess, when you got that back.
Yes, it's again one of the overarching things with what we do and. Particularly with this project, was that we wanted, we don't want to force feed or spoon feed the listener, like this is what it's all about. And it's always intriguing, I've found, you know, in the years we've been doing this, to hear what the listeners feel when they listen to a track that I've written, you know, and they will go, well, is it about, I think it's about a car crash. And in my head, I just go, no, it's not about a car crash at all. But if that's what you're, you know, feel when you listen to the track, then your truth is just as much worth as mine. So that was the sort of idea, I guess, when we did the movies. It's fun to see what an artistic person, a director, see in her or his mind when listening to our track. What kind of imagery can they conjure up to accommodate the music that we have made? So it was a very self-centered experience. It was fun for us to be given these little trinkets along the way, and you just go, "Oh wow, never thought of that. Interesting." Yeah.
With this much of an ambitious project, three mm-hmm. albums, box set, imagery per song, video per song, was there anything that was discussed or talked about that wasn't able to be done?
We had some ideas for a live show that just fell apart literally due to the pandemic, because, you know, traveling across borders and so on became impossible and just too expensive and slow and so on. But it never came to the point where we had like a full A to Z sort of plan on what to do. But there were some ideas floating around, but we needed to work with, you know, lights and screens and all that stuff to make mm-hmm. it happen. So that didn't happen. But, you know, who knows in the future, you know, we can do a Roger Waters kind of thing and it's going to be amazing.
All right. Well, actually, you guys are, I am seeing some tour dates pop up on rocksup.com. So maybe there is an opportunity for some of those original ideas to manifest in the live theater. Svend, again, thank you so much for spending time with us here and for really going deep into the profound mysteries, releases, what it took to put that together, a Herculean task. probably the best way to describe it. And of course, for sharing some of those memories of the early days, the early records, the Banksy release, and so much more. And we hope to see some of the other releases of the Royksopp catalog come out on vinyl at some point. There's a lot of people waiting for them, so hopefully that's sooner than later. I do want to direct folks to the website profoundmysteries.royksopp.com. If you're not sure how to spell it, I'll have a link in the episode page where you can check out the vinyl from the Profound Mystery series. Number 3 is available on streaming. The 3rd and final version is available on streaming November 18th. So you could actually hear it on your streaming services. You can hear 1 and 2 right now and then set yourself up to get number 3 when it's available on November 18th. Royksopp.com. And again, Svend, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much, Nathan. It's been an absolute treat talking to you.
All right, there we go. Svend Bierg of Royksopp. Thank you very much for coming on The Vinyl Guide. And by the way, I've got images of Sven's Banksy records up at patreon.com/vinylguide. There's also an extended version of our conversation up there. Help support the show at patreon.com/vinylguide. And I would highly recommend grabbing a copy of the Profound Mysteries box set. Just about every bit of vinyl that Royksopp puts out becomes highly collectible. So get into the box set while the getting's good. profoundmysteries.royksopp.com. And that is it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Share them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter if it still exists. Share on Instagram at Vinyl Guide, and even tell your friends in the analog world. Show them how to get a podcast on that smartphone of theirs. Show them The Vinyl Guide. They will appreciate it, and so will I. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.